This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of NPR's very best arts and culture stories. I am Neda Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Alicia Montgomery, producer for Tell Me More.
As always, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
Sandra Bullock discusses her Oscar-nominated role in The Blind Side.
Then one of the folks behind this year's Oscars telecast talks about some of the changes in the works.
And actress-turned-singer Charlotte Gainsbourg teams up with Beck for a new album, IRM. But first,
the theme for next month's Academy Awards ceremony appears to be more. 10 Best Picture nominees, 2 hosts. This year's Oscars may not even end before Monday morning. But our film critic Bob Mondello says there is a way to make a long night shorter. He offers this modest proposal.
As long as we're having categories with 10 nominees, I know how the Academy can save time, eliminate 2 acceptance speeches, and strike a blow against sexism all in one fell swoop. Just make the Oscars gender neutral. Nobody says best director and best directress, or best editor and best editress. So why best actor and best actress? Combine them and let the best performer win. I mean, seriously, who cares about Colin Firth versus George Clooney when you can pit Sandra Bullock against Jeff Bridges in a brawl of the drawls?
I don't need y'all to approve my choices, all right? But I do ask that you respect them.
I'm Bab Blake. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just gonna stay bad.
Now, I can just hear the objections to combining categories. Men get all the roles, they're higher paid, their pictures have bigger budgets. And let me concede most of that, but note that it's new. I'm guessing the Motion Picture Academy's original logic for separating the acting awards by gender was that if they hadn't, in the 1920s and 30s, Joan Crawford and Greta Garbo would have walked off with all the trophies. Take 1935. It was such a good year for the likes of Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, Merle Oberon, and Claudette Colbert that they had to add a 6th slot in the Best Actress category. The men, meanwhile, couldn't even field a full slate. Only 4 nominees, and the 3 who didn't win all came from one picture, Mutiny on the Bounty.
You're sending me to my doom, eh? I'll live to see you, all of you, hanging from the highest yardarm in the British fleet.
Who knows what they'd have done if the Bounty hadn't sailed until the following year. Yes, of course, the game has changed since then, but in a way that could actually work against men at Oscar time. Men monopolize blockbusters, which never win acting awards. You want that neutered gold statue these days. You have to play in what used to be called women's pictures, something more touchy-feely. Besides, acting's not like a shot put competition. Body mass and physical strength don't give men an advantage when it comes to emoting effectively. I mean, look at this year's supporting actor nominees. No disrespect to Matt Damon's rugby playing, or Woody Harrelson's crying, Christopher Plummer's erudite dithering, or the respective killing styles of Stanley Tucci and Christoph Waltz. But not one of those guys would stand a chance if he had to compete with Monique's ferociously manipulative mom.
So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me? Who was going to make me feel good?
The Academy will almost certainly make Monique feel good on Oscar night, and that would be no less true if she were competing with the boys. I'm Bob Mondello.
Well, that's a really intriguing idea for shortening the Oscars, and it would certainly add more excitement than just adding another 5 pictures to the Best Picture category, which as a fan of the Oscars is something that I absolutely dread. I can't believe that they're going to come up with 10 terrible musical numbers instead of 5. Netta, how do you feel about it?
I want to see the musical number based on The Blind Side.
What I want to see is the one based on District 9 with the aliens battling the cops and black spandex. But going to one of the more competitive Oscar races, Best Actress. One of the big surprises of last year's box office and this year's Oscar race is a small movie about football, family, and Christian faith, The Blind Side. It's based on a true story of a white family from Memphis, the Tuies, who take in an African-American teenager who has no place to live. As much of a surprise as the Best Picture nod was, so were many critics not necessarily thrilled, but certainly shocked, that Sandra Bullock won a Best Actress nomination for her role. In this scene from the film, she meets the teenaged Michael Oher for the first time.
Hey, my name's Leanne Toohey. My kids go to Wingate. You said you were going to the gym? School gym's closed. Why were you going to the gym?
Because it's warm.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me. Come on.
Sandra Bullock spoke to Linda Wertheimer about what attracted her to the part.
When you read a character like that in a script, as I did, you often think that it was made up or sort of turned into a caricature just to make a movie. And that's why I think for the longest time I kept saying no, because I didn't know how to play this woman. And then I met her and realized she is that person that I read on the script, if not more.
Is that how you found your way into the role and into her life, by meeting her and experiencing what it would be like to be this woman?
To be Leanne Toohey? Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I'd spent over half a year just saying no to the project, and finally the director just said, you know, why don't you just come meet Leanne and you'll understand why I can't describe her. And I found myself near Memphis, and I said, well, I'll stop by, and I did, and spent maybe 8 hours with her. And you know, I was intimidated by her, I was intrigued by her, and by the end of the day, I wanted to make sure that I left on her good side, because you don't want to be on Leanne Toohey's bad side. And I think like about a month later, I was scared enough to sort of say, you know, if I'm going to do this, I need to be able to prepare for it enough. So just allow me the time with my great dialects coach and let me get to a place where I can make Leanne Toohey real rather than someone who's this cartoon version of Steel Magnolia, which I think it easily could have become.
We have another clip from the movie, which gives you an impression of what Leanne can be like. She interrupts Michael's football practice to give him some advice.
Do you remember when we first met and we went to that horrible part of town to buy you those dreadful clothes? And I was a little bit scared and you told me not to worry about it because you had my back. Do you remember that?
Yes, ma'am.
This team is your family, Michael. You have to protect them from those guys, okay? Listen, Tony here is your quarterback, all right? You protect his blind side. When you look at him, you think of me, how you have my back, how you have his. Okay?
Now, when she does this, she grabs the quarterback by the front of his jersey and drags him over to the conversation.
That's Leanne. I mean, none of that is exaggerated. She just is unafraid. She'll grab me by the face if she needs to. And when I first met her, the next thing I knew, she was taking me into the school where that high school was, and they were in class. And she literally barged into the principal's office, who was obviously having a very important meeting, not knocking. She just made her way in there and then proceeded to want to interrupt her son's Bible class to introduce me to her son. And the school literally parted like the Red Sea. And, you know, I'm overly cautious about everything. And she is not about anything. And that's why she gets things done.
Your career, you've made lots of films in which you play physical comedy very well. Most recently in The Proposal, you played an unlikable character, which, you know, everybody thought was totally against type in Crash.
Or totally type, and I've just kept it hidden.
Yes, so it could be that. Well, so what? But the character in The Blind Side, was it really that much of a reach? I mean, it's sort of Sandra Bullock being smart and southern and sassy, and we've seen that before.
Well, I mean, if it was easy for me to get to, I was taking the long road there. You know, I spent 3 months panicking of how to make this something I wouldn't get raked over the coals for. You know, you just have to dive in and commit 100%, as I do in most things. And, you know, if I'm going to mess up, I'd like to mess up big.
Well, Netta, you know, this is a movie that we talked a lot about at Tell Me More. And one of the things that we all confessed, and there were people on the team, our production squad, that really liked this movie. And my brother, God bless him, really liked this movie too. But, you know, if I see another movie about some poor black soul who was rescued by some kindly white people, I mean, I know that this is a true story, but it feels a little bit like a cliche, and maybe that's why I'm just not attracted to the film, even though I'm a fan of Sandra Bullock. How do you feel about that?
I've seen the movie, and and honestly, I don't know if it's one that I would have rushed out to see if I didn't cover the arts and feel an obligation to see all of the movies that get buzz. I thought she did a great job, and I completely agree with you. And I was actually just talking with our producer, Michael Katziv, about an article that was in Entertainment Weekly that was talking about how one of the problems with this movie, and there are many, including primarily what you're bringing up, but the movie doesn't let Michael Ower be a real teenager. In the book, which I have not read, apparently you get a really full picture, not just of him, but of how his success was due in large part also to the Black community that he belonged to, which mm-hmm. is utterly absent from this movie.
Well, it still sounds like a worthy performance, and so maybe all of us haters need to give Sandra Bullock another chance.
Oscars, you know, Oscars is a special night for the haters. And that makes the job of someone like Adam Shankman very difficult. He's the guy who puts on the entire shebang. And neither he nor the other producer, Bill Mechanic, has ever done it before. Mechanic and Shankman are making some changes this year. Shankman is bringing some experience to this. He directed Bringing Down the House and the movie musical remake of John Waters' already perfect film, Hairspray. He's also a choreographer who got his start dancing and choreographing for music videos, and he was a judge on the TV show So You Think You Can Dance. So Shankman recently sat down with Fresh Air's Terry Gross to talk about what types of changes they're planning for Hollywood's biggest night.
We first had a pretty radical idea about who we wanted to host the show, which the Academy swatted down. Because
you're not going to tell me who
that
was,
wild
right?
You know what? I'm actually going to tell you. It was Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh no!
And,
oh wow!
They thought it was too big a wild card. Too unpredictable.
Oh, what a good reason to watch.
Hello, that's my thing. I mean, you know, once you get hired to do the show, we don't control the nominations, we don't control the winners, but we control, you know, everything around all of that stuff. And our job is to put on the best show possible and really give the audience, not just the people in the room, but the viewing audience, the people who pay our bills, you know, a great, great evening.
I loved the idea. Yeah, if you had Sacha Baron Cohen hosting, you don't even know who'd be hosting. Because he might do it as one of his characters.
I know. I mean, it would just be spectacular. But I think the Academy felt like that. Not only is it unpredictable, but it could overshadow the nominees. And then we immediately went to this idea of co-hosts. And the very cool thing about the co-host thing is that we didn't realize there haven't been co-hosts in this fashion since 1928, which was the first year of the show. And so that's another way that it's going to be very, very different, because they're going to share the duties. Their comedy is going to be very, very snappy. We all loved the way that Neil Patrick Harris did the Emmys, how he really kept them moving along. And Alec and Steve are going to be in there doing a lot of that stuff, too. But what the great thing was by having Steve, it anchors it in kind of a tradition. And he is one of the most beloved hosts of the show they've ever had. And then we thought Alec made a great comic wild card, and they bring out the funniest versions of themselves with each other. The chemistry between them is so magical. When I say it's like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, I'm not kidding.
Are they going to sing?
I'm not going to tell you that. Oh. That would ruin a surprise.
So tell me one
Chipmunk.
Thing. That's our safe word.
That's our safe word when she starts going into territory that I'm not going to talk about. Chipmunk.
We need a safe word, Alicia.
And Chipmunk is taken.
And you know what I could really use a safe word?
What?
It's when certain actors try to sing. Well, generally, Charlotte Gainsbourg is someone who can pull this off. And she comes with a heck of a pedigree. She's the daughter of French pop star Serge Gainsbourg and the English actress and handbag muse Jane Birkin. And, okay, that brings almost unreasonably high expectations to someone like Charlotte Gainsbourg. But she's really blazed an interesting trail for herself, both as an actress and as a singer-songwriter. She's able to attract top-shelf collaborators like Beck, who helped produce and write the songs on her latest album, IRM. And as Gainsbourg recently told Jackie Leiden, it was partially inspired by a health scare that required frequent hospital trips for MRI scans, or IRM in French.
It all began for me with an accident, water skiing. I had a lot of MRIs to go through, surgery, and so quite a dramatic time for me. But hearing those sounds in that scan machine, I felt that I just wanted to do something with those sounds, put them on music. It was my first input on an idea of a song. And then I started working with Beck and then talked to him about this idea that he loved, and that's how we did it. Take a picture, what's inside?
The lyrics, which I believe he wrote, say, take a picture, what's inside, ghost imaging my mind.
Neural pattern like a spider. He wrote all the lyrics. And apparently he didn't know that I had had that accident and that I actually had a hole in my head.
You came so close to the edge. Could I just, the fatal edge, and I'm so sorry that you did. How's it changed your outlook on life, or has it?
It changed straight after going through the surgery when I realized that I was still alive. And it's true that you look at life in a different way, but that disappears after a few months. I didn't really like what I saw about myself after that accident because I became very, very fragile. It took me a very long time to overcome all this, and the work on the album helped me a lot.
What did you like about Beck's work that made you want to work with him? There must be quite a bit, actually.
Quite a bit. I love his work. I'm very, very attracted to his voice. It's a weird thing of, you know, wanting to work with someone but to want to put your voice instead of his, because I do love the way he sings, and I'm very proud to have made this duo, you know, Heaven Can Wait, where you can hear him.
And now to another music story. A few years ago, blues guitarist Eric Bibb walked into his hotel after a gig in London. A fan carrying a guitar case approached him, and in that case he found a vintage 1930s guitar that once belonged to blues legend Booker White. Bibb later convinced that fan to lend him the guitar, and with it he produced a record inspired by White's pre-war Delta blues sound. The album is appropriately titled Booker's Guitar. Bibb recently spoke to NPR's Guy Raz about the guitar and played a song from the new record.
This is a song that just came to me as a way of revisiting some of the imagery and zones that my heroes inhabited, wandering around, traipsing around the American South playing their music. Hence the title, Walkin' Blues Again. Stop it, it's like a runaway train pumping through your heart, running around your brain, talking about the walking blues, my friend. Play it when I'm sad, play it when I'm happy again. John Henry had a habit, I've been told, would ring like silver, shine like gold. Talking about a steel driving man. Just like John, I'm doing just the best that I can.
Listening to that song and reading your notes about it, you talk about how it taps into a righteous anger that many of my heroes must have felt.
Yeah, you know, the whole culture and the whole atmosphere that embraced the whole blues tradition was so much more than just wonderful music. It was the whole historical reality of Southern racism, post-slavery trauma, all of the above. And when we think of these pre-war blues heroes, we're concentrating on their wonderful music, this incredible sound born of all kinds of pain and oppression. What I wanted to just refer to without beating it over the head with a hammer was a sense of rage even that obviously had to be tucked in big time for survival. As a blues musician who feels connected to the tradition living in this new century, I felt it was appropriate and my responsibility even to just make a reference to those things that I'm talking about, and in a lyric, let it come out without it taking over.
You can hear that full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Finally, we take a moment to remember the life of poet Lucille Clifton. Clifton was the first black woman to win the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, one of the most prestigious awards for an American poet. Clifton died recently at the age of 73. Here in this clip, Clifton reads from one of her poems, Wishes for Sons.
This is a poem for my sons and for other people's sons as well. And I often say, I don't think there's a woman over 12 who hasn't thought this. So, wishes for sons. I wish them cramps. I wish them a strange town and the last tampon. I wish them no 7-Eleven. I wish them 1 week early and wearing a white skirt. I wish them 1 week late. Later, I wish them hot flashes and clots like you wouldn't believe. Let the flashes come when they meet someone special. Let the clots come when they want to. Let them think they have accepted arrogance in the universe. Then bring them to gynecologists, not unlike themselves. And, you know, I've read this. And now, people say, do you read that in front of males? Of course. I mean, I read everything in front of everybody. And a young man once came up to me and he said, excuse me, I went to an all-male school and I have no sisters and I have a girlfriend. Can you be a week late? And I said, yes, you can. And I think this is very important information. And I'm glad you asked me. It was so brave of you to ask me. Absolutely, I said. So you need to know this. This is good. And he was, well, thank you. He was so excited. But I think that the proper subject matter for poetry is life. I tell students all the time that there are people who would say, well, how can I relate to your poetry? I'm a white male. But I write about being human. If you have ever been human, I invite you to that place where that we share, and I think you can then share it.
All I can say out of that is Lucille Clifton is a great voice that will be greatly missed.
And unlike some women, this podcast is regular every week, and that's it for this one.
Priceless. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Alicia Montgomery.
And I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.
Running around your brain, talking about the walking blues, my friend. Play it when I'm sad, play it when I'm happy.